Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 22nd, 2022. We have six cases on our calendar today, three for oral argument. Our first matter is A21-1360 Johnson versus State. Counsel, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please pay attention to the clock, which will be running. The marshal will run the clock. I'd ask that you state your name and your client's name before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded. No other recordings are permitted. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauch Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Ms. Raylene Johnson. Ms. Johnson has presented 5 issues for this court's consideration. And although I am happy to answer questions on any of those issues, this morning I would like to focus my argument on issues 3 and 4 pertaining to the exclusion of defense evidence and the introduction of Spriegel evidence. And that is because Ms. Johnson stands convicted of 3 offenses in this case, even if we are successful in reversing, getting this court to reverse 2 of those convictions based on the sufficiency arguments. That third conviction makes those new trial issues significantly important. The third issue challenges the district court's exclusion of Ms. Johnson's evidence to prove her reasonable belief defense. Minnesota statute section 609.26 subdivision 2 required her to prove that she reasonably believed the action taken was necessary to protect her child.
So, counsel, when I look at the offer of proof that was made at the evidentiary hearing on this motion in limine, I didn't see anything specific other than a reference to one person maybe talking about something that they had heard or observed in 2015 or 2016, which is 5 years before the incident at issue. Isn't it your client's burden to make an offer of proof to demonstrate that those things that she wanted introduced were pertinent and not speculative, not opinion, not hearsay, et cetera?
Certainly, Your Honor. So the offer of proof at the May 5th evidentiary hearing included 3 different subcategories of evidence. One of those was that witnesses, including a Kyle Johnson, had observed and heard the child make statements when he was going to be given back to his father, indicating that he was scared. His father heard him. He didn't want to go back. That's one category. The second category is the witnesses who had observed bruises, marks, and a bloody diaper. This included an Isaac Froelich, which is the 2015 incident.
And none of these were specific as to time. I mean, there were no details really given at this hearing.
Well, I don't know that any more details were necessary for the court to determine that the evidence was relevant. So keep in mind, when the district court excluded this evidence, all the court says was, we're not going down this rabbit hole. That's not what this trial is about. The legal analysis was relatively sparse. And that's exactly what this trial was about.
I'm kind of piggybacking on Judge Frisch's question because, you know, when I look at the record as a whole, I even look at the disclosure of witness lists and everything just seems to be general allegations that maybe somebody will come. Even the claim that the Exchange Club Center was going to speak to the issues, it doesn't say who, it doesn't say what they're going to talk about. It's just kind of a rambling list. And I don't know that that meets your burden in terms of your offer of proof. Can you expand on that? Or where in the record are we going to find the offer of proof with specificity that you seem to be arguing?
So the offer of proof is at the May 5th evidentiary hearing. It's contained starting at pages 8 and 9 and continues thereon for several pages of transcript. Again, the district court didn't exclude this evidence because it was speculative or because it was not specific enough. We have names of witnesses, we have rough dates, and the exclusion was not on any of the legal bases that we've been discussing this morning, but instead was sort of a generalized, we're just not going to do that. Her defense is that she reasonably believed that Mr. Root had been abusing this child over a length of time. That's relevant.
Now tell me, how can you say that she was deprived of the opportunity to present this defense when about 20 pages of her transcript is her testimony about it. And then there's mom who testifies about it and sister who testifies about it and a CPS investigator who testifies about it. And all of that testimony is, I think, the universe of testimony about the time period where she did retain the child and not deliver the child back to dad.
Yes, Your Honor. So I think a helpful shorthand to think about what was included versus excluded here is the district court allowed testimony about the charged time frame, which is roughly a week, but excluded everything from beyond that time frame. So there's nothing outside of this 1 week in August to September, all of which other evidence substantiated her reasonable belief. Again, she, by statute, she's got to prove what she reasonably believed. So the fact that other people have observed injuries, other people have heard the child say things, and frankly, her own testimony to what she believed is all relevant. The fact that other evidence was let in perhaps goes to harmlessness, but again, we're in the full damaging potential harmlessness analysis here, which is the jury would have felt differently had they heard not just Ms. Johnson, but other people come in and testify that they'd observed this behavior from the child, they'd seen injuries on the child over a length of years, which is exactly what her claim is, that this reasonable belief, Your Honor, was just based on years.
Can I turn your attention to the Spriegel issue?
Yes.
Can you tell me what is it about the district court's order that is not specific enough with respect to Ness, with respect to your argument about Ness, when the issue of her intent is, I think, central to both, I guess, all three of the charges and also her defense. And I think that's, I mean, that is mentioned several times in the district court's order. So what else does the district court have to say to satisfy the Ness standard?
Certainly, Your Honor. I will respectfully disagree that this case hinged on her intent. Her intent is not relevant at all to either the state's proof or her defense. She quite clearly testifies that she did this intentionally. This is the kind of defense, it's like self-defense, right? It's the kind of defense that requires the defendant to get up and basically say, I did this conduct, but I had a reason, right? So her testimony alone basically satisfies.
I thought in closing argument, counsel for Ms. Johnson specifically indicated that the state was required to prove that she intended to keep him for some reason other than the purpose for which she was claiming. And I mean, so it seems as though counsel conceded that intent was at issue and that the state hadn't proven that she intended to keep him.
I don't recall that portion, Your Honor. I'm not disagreeing with your reading of the closing, but I do think what the statute requires is that she sort of intentionally keep him to substantially deprive. Again, she admits that. She didn't do it accidentally. She didn't make a mistake. She was very clear. She says, I knew what I was doing. I knew I could get in trouble, but I did it to protect my child. So it's not really her intent that's at issue. It's her reasonable belief that it was necessary to protect her child from harm. And I think the problem with the district court's order is the district court doesn't do any of the analysis that's required by case law. The purpose, right? So kind of what we think of as the second factor of Spriegel, the state had listed some five or six potential purposes, some of which are clearly inapplicable. The district court said you listed 404B purposes, those are reasonable. That was it. There's no probing for the true purpose. And I would ask this court to hold the state to its word, which is we want this evidence to show a pattern. That's what was said at the 421 hearing. That's what they told the jury in opening. That's what they told the jury in closing. Over and over and over again, she did it before and she's trying to do it again. That's propensity reasoning. That's exactly what Rule 404B disallows.
Isn't it also absence of mistake?
Again, I would disagree. Ms. Johnson never says she made a mistake. She says she did it intentionally, purposefully, knowingly. And under sort of Ness in that line of case law, we look for the sort of true legitimate purpose where one of these 404B purposes is disputed. That's why, in addition, the district court also under relevance has to look for a disputed fact. Whether it was a mistake or not isn't remotely disputed. The state never even argued she made a mistake. In fact, in closing argument, the state said quite pointedly, this is not a case where she made a mistake. This is not a case of two parents who are disagreeing, who are confused about the order. She didn't make a mistake. So that's clearly not disputed. And again, even on the relevant prong of Spriegel, the district court's order is problematic because it simply says, the state says it's relevant for all these purposes, so it's relevant. There's really thin, if any, analysis. We also, of course, under the relevance prong, have to look at the similarity. And I just firmly disagree that these were similar incidents. You have spoofing of text messages, the use of technology to sort of falsify fake communications indicating really bad stuff. And then there's nothing like that in the present incident. I would disagree that they're similar. That's one part of it. And I would disagree that anyone in this case has identified a precise disputed fact to which this prior incident is relevant. It's furthered in the district court's analysis on prong five, on the prejudice prong, when the court says, well, the probative value is to support the state's burden of proof. I don't know that I've ever heard that in my 8 years of practice in a Spriegel analysis. You could say that in every single case, that Spriegel evidence helps the state satisfy its burden of proof. I don't think that's a sort of legitimate legal analysis to say that's why it's probative. It actually has very low probative value because we know it doesn't go to any of the legit 404B purposes. It's not relevant. And instead, it's massively prejudicial. It allows this argument that she did it before, so she's probably doing it again. Jury, I want you to focus on this. The fact that she did this before, that's just pure propensity reasoning. Because those three aspects of the Spriegel analysis are missing, we would ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial on any of the counts still standing after the sufficiency issues.
Ms. Yalk-Erickson, I don't want to interrupt my colleagues questioning on issues 3 and 4, but I have a question about your first argument, sufficiency on the concealment conviction. So in light of your statement that it's not about intent, what are the remaining issues with respect to the concealment conviction? I mean, what evidence is lacking there?
Certainly, Your Honor. So Fitman provides a really nice example to show that Ms. Johnson did not conceal this child. I think we can think of that as sort of the actus reus of the crime. Certainly she has to do it intentionally, not accidentally, but she also has to do an act that is concealment. And what
your brief tends to focus on the time period before Tuesday, September 1, that was the day that she went to the Mankato Hospital. But it seems like you don't dwell much on that day. I mean, why is her conduct on that day not concealment?
Certainly, Your Honor. So what we know from Fitman, and frankly, also from Fellner, the unpublished case cited by my opponent, is that it's not enough if the co-parent does not know where the child is, and it's not enough if law enforcement and or the co-parent don't visibly see the child. And that is at most what we have on September 1st. We know where they are. They're at the hospital. She wasn't absconding to a different state. They're out in public. And what the state has to prove under Fitman, Your Honor. Is that Ms. Johnson has to be hiding him, actively concealing him from his co-parent. And that is missing here. We have none of the behavior that existed in Fellner, blocking of phone calls, refusing to answer phone calls, refusing to allow the co-parent in when she showed up at the place where the children were. We don't have any of that behavior. Instead, we have a relatively active pattern of communication that extended at least until Monday, August 31st. And after that, at a minimum, we have sort of the absence of anything. But what we don't have is conduct of hiding or concealing from Mr. Root.
Mr. Root's request to pick the child up when she said that, reported that he was ill, and there was at least some limited discussion between mom and dad as far as her refusal to let him come and pick the child up. I mean, isn't that enough?
No, Your Honor. I would say actually that fact supports our argument because it shows that Mr. Root knew exactly where the child was. If he thought he could go pick him up from mom's apartment, that means the child is at mom's apartment. And again, Fitman is really useful here because in Fitman, no one saw the children. Police didn't see the children. the parent who wanted access didn't see the children, and the court said there's no evidence that those kids were anywhere than other they were presumed to be. So the lack of sort of sight, the lack of visibility does not by itself establish concealment. The Fitmans were doing the exact same thing, saying, no, you can't have these kids. And that wasn't enough. That perhaps proves the other form of deprivation of parental rights, the sort of pure violation of the order. But this court was very clear in Fitman, they're different crimes. The legislature designed them to sort of attack different behavior. And the concealment crime was originally conceived as parental kidnapping, right? That it's really the parent, they give a list of examples, who abscond with kids. That's simply not what happened here. So I would ask this court to reverse Ms. Johnson's deprivation of parental rights concealment conviction. And I will I am out of time, so I will conclude my argument there. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel?
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Rachel Cornelius. I'm the Waseca County attorney. I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. Your honors, we are here on several different matters. I'll start with also the same thing as opposing counsel. I'll start with the Spriegel and the evidence issues, as those seem to be the biggest ones that are before the court that are the most contentious. With regards to issue number three, I wholeheartedly believe that the district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied the defense's request. As your honors were mentioning, this information that they were trying to get in was the old unsubstantiated evidence, continued allegations by Ms. Johnson against Mr. Root over the years. They were things that had continued on and on. They were provided again in discovery as a request to have these people testify about these things that happened over, in some of the cases, one of the witnesses, they hadn't even seen the child for over 2 years. And that was pretty consistent throughout the different statements that they were trying to get in. So I would say that the court did not abuse its discretion when it denied all that old evidence to come in.
Counsel, can I direct your attention to count one, the concealment charge?
Absolutely.
So in this case, you have convictions for both counts one and count two under the same statute. Is there a particular reason why you're contesting the validity of the conviction under count one? I mean, if we reverse count one and send it back for sentencing on count two, you're in the same place. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that.
All right. So now tell me where the evidence is that Ms. Johnson was concealing the child, hiding the child from dad.
I think that the best evidence of where that mom was hiding the child was the fact that she refused to let him come to the residence to put the eyes on the child, to at least attempt. There was testimony about how he had a phone. He was allowed to call dad in the past. He wasn't in contact with dad over the weekend. So dad didn't know exactly where he was. He respected the wishes to not go to the residence.
That's his choice to respect the wishes, but he's being told that the child is at the residence, right?
Correct. But she could also
post, and then he puts a Facebook post up on September 1 saying that my child's been kidnapped, and then grandma puts a picture of the child up and says we're at the hospital, right?
Correct.
So yep. where's the proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this child is being hidden from dad?
I think that in those days where he didn't know where the child was, there was testimony that at some point he thought maybe she might have left the state because he had not seen his child or talked to his child for a week. I think that it's a reasonable inference when he says Texas, that she had a boyfriend in Texas, that maybe she left, because normally he would hear from his son on the weekends, I believe was the testimony. I think that I do agree that it's implied. I mean, he did say in his testimony, Mr. Roots testified that typically mom would be at her apartment or at her parents, but also he knew law enforcement went to her apartment and went to her parents' house and they weren't there. So what's he led to believe? Okay, where are they? So then I truly believe that at that point that the child is concealed from his father because he doesn't know. I mean, you can say anything you want. She can say, oh, he's home sick with me. We don't know where they are. It's a telephone call. So
the weekend was mother's parenting time, correct?
Correct.
So far in answering Judge Frisch's questions, you seem to be focusing on the August dates when he was homesick from daycare and the weekend, but are you not relying on the evidence of what occurred on September 1 when she went to the Mankato Hospital?
No, I'm saying on Monday and Tuesday that August 31st, September 1st, that was the days, that Monday, Tuesday, and Tuesday was the hospital day, that she absolutely was concealing the child. I mean, the court order too. I mean, she only has physical, she has visitation. She doesn't have any physical or legal custody to take the child to the hospital, doesn't have any rights to get medical records, those types of things, or to take him. And I think that was part of the phased parenting agreement. I mean, I know for a fact, of course, and that's what count two was that the fact that the child was not supposed to be in her care when she was sick. But regarding to the concealment, yes, she concealed the child. She never told the father, I'm going to take him to the hospital. And in fact, remember the day before.
Ms. Cornelius, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I mean, I'm focused on the language in Fitman that says the legislature saw concealing a child as separate from, not synonymous with, taking, obtaining, retaining, or failing to return a child. So the things that you're describing in response to Judge Johnson's question are taking the child and not returning the child and retaining the child. But you're not talking about hiding the child, which is what Fitman says in the next paragraph. Case law indicates that concealment cases brought under 60926 sub 1 have involved parents or guardians who go into hiding with the children. So where's the evidence of that in the record? Because I did not see it.
I don't know that. I think it's just implied. She didn't know where he was. He didn't know where his child was. And he didn't know how to find his child. He was asking for law enforcement's help to get his child.
You rely in your position on that on State versus Bellner, in which the court tried to distinguish the concealment, but the facts in Fellner, of course, I was on that panel, are a little more egregious than here. What out of all of the facts that you feel fall under the Fellner inability to have the awareness of the child, what factors do you think are most in your favor?
The things that I thought were relevant in Fellner are the fact that that your court decided that the mother was prevented from discovering the children's whereabouts. In this case, I feel that the father was prevented from the child's whereabouts. He was told he couldn't come to the residence on Monday, that following Monday, when the child should have been returned to school daycare. The child was not there, so he still did not know where the child was. She texted him and said, well, I'm just keeping the child.
So was there record evidence then that he was explicitly told not to come to the residence?
Yes, Your Honor. So he on Friday, he said, no, Thursday, that was his sick day. On Thursday, he said, well, I'll come get him then at 3:00. And she said, do not come to my residence. I will move to any other section that you guys want me to talk about too, if you want me to move to something else.
Well, I think maybe it's a good idea to talk about the Spriegel issue, okay, given that, you know, counsel's argument is that intent was not an issue in this particular case. And there was...
Before you launch into that, I'm just concerned that appellant counsel is able to hear what's going on. I know she's not visible on the screen. Oh, there you are. Okay.
With regards to the Spriegel, I'll start with a few things. First of all, I did see the part where Your Honor saw where the defense attorney in her closing did say that I have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was intentionally and actively hiding Riley from his dad. So I do believe that that was part of the intent that I had to prove. I also had to prove, I think that motive was very relevant to say, like, why would you? Well, this is something that she's tried, you know, before. Yes, I use the term pattern, but it's also the same thing as modus operandi, but it's not like you're going to use that term with a jury necessarily. I would note that really the absence of mistake is the big thing here, because even though I said in my closing, you know, she didn't make a mistake, because that's exactly what I'm saying, is there was no absence of mistake here, because she specifically knew what she was doing. She knew she had a court order. She knew what it meant to keep the child from the father. She knew what child protection was. She knew what it meant to make a report to a law enforcement officer and have those investigations relied upon, because that's what happened in the last case. Also, I think that the most important thing is that, you know, that case was, although it doesn't have to be exact, we know that Spriegel has to have, you know, it has to be significantly relevant to what we're here for. And this was exactly relevant for what we were here for. This was the same parties, the same parents, the same child, and the closer the relationship between the Spriegel bad acts and the events that are underlying, everyone knows that that is the more likelihood it's going to be proper Spriegel, as was argued, and, you know, as was the argument and understanding, that's what should have happened here too. And the court did agree. The court knew that those facts underlying were substantially similar to the charged offense. It doesn't matter that in this case, she didn't send herself fake text messages. The underlying facts of the Spriegel incident in this case are the same, in that child was taken from his father in the other case by law enforcement, because mom sent herself text messages saying that the dad was going to kill the child, harm the child, do horrible things to the child. But how is that any different than going to the hospital and saying, oh, look at, he's all covered in bruises. He's got a brain bleed. He's got all these things wrong with him. Yet the doctors see nothing of that. They see undated pictures. They see the child who seems to be functioning completely normally. And there's absolutely nothing for them to be concerned about. They say follow up with other specialists, and the one doctor diagnosed him with a headache. So again, this was strong evidence that related to the two cases. I don't see how this Spriegel evidence was should have been admitted. This was exactly why we have Spriegel. I know that this was one of the minor cases issues, but with counts, but regards to the falsely reporting a crime in Waseca County, I would just note that you report a crime to where the crime occurred. And so in this case, she reported to law enforcement in the jurisdiction where, you know, the crime would have occurred. So she's alleging child abuse happening at the hands of Mr. Root. That would have happened in Waseca County. You know, you wouldn't call Rice County and say, hey, my child was abused in Waseca County. You would call Waseca County. So again, I think that falsely reporting a crime did occur in Waseca County. And I don't think that there is much to articulate there. In the reply brief from the appellant, they complained that I didn't cite to where appellant communicated to Waseca County by telephone. Well, that's exhibit one. That's the phone call from Ms. Johnson to Detective Brass, specifically outlining all the supposed allegations and all the things that were wrong with her child at the hands of Mr. Root. I don't really have anything else at this time, unless anyone has any other questions for me.
Anything else from the panel? All right. Thank you very much, Counsel.
Thank you for your time.
Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I appreciate so much your concern, Judge Werke. I was just taking a moment to sit down. Perhaps I'll begin with the venue issue. Respondent misunderstands my argument. My argument was they did not prove, because they never asked a single question, where Detective Brent Brass was located when he received the phone call. So this case is actually very similar to Pierce. In Pierce, it was an OFP violation, and the state did not prove where either party was, either when the communication was sent or the communication was received. And this court held there's neither direct or circumstantial evidence to satisfy the venue element of that crime. The state had to prove that the crime, the offense, occurred in Waseca County. Ms. Johnson was very clearly in Blue Earth County. All of the evidence indicates that. The doctors say that's where the hospital is. I believe the police officer concedes that's where she was. The state could have asked one question: where were you when you got that phone call? But they didn't. I'm not sure even that would be sufficient, because I maintain that the crime occurs based on the reporting, the provision of information, the informing of the officer. But even if I'm wrong, and even if receipt of the information is an element or the element, they didn't prove that either. It doesn't matter where you generally report crimes to. You have to prove every element of the offense. The offense is committed upon the provision or information to an officer. And we don't know where the officer was. This is just like Pierce. Just like Pierce, where the state failed to establish where the recipient of the information was when they received that information.
To be clear, are you accepting that Pierce applies? The Pierce rule, I think, is that it's where the sender is or the receiver is. Are you conceding that rule applies?
No, Your Honor, because the elements here are actually different than the element of the OFP violation statute. So this court really keyed in on Pierce in the word contact and concluded, as a matter of statutory interpretation, that the word contact implies both the need to send and the need to receive. Therefore, receipt was an element of the offense. The verbs in this statute are different. We have informs and we have provides, which are, I would argue, more one-way sort of verbs that don't require receipt of the information, certainly as an element. I actually think it's quite odd to require the receipt of the information as an element of the offense. So not necessarily, no, but even if this court concludes that Pierce does apply, receipt is an element, they still didn't prove where the call was received. Did he receive the call? Yes. Exhibit one is the phone call where they talked to each other, but no information about where he was.
So with respect to your alternative argument, if we do apply something like Pierce, correct that in Pierce we held, this court analyzed the circumstantial evidence and concluded that it was lacking. Might this case be different? Because I think that the recipient in Pierce was an individual who, you know, may or may not be at the residence and so on. Here, the officer, we know the officer is a officer of the Waseca Police Department and was doing his job at these times. And I think even asked her to meet him or to meet somebody at the Waseca Police Department. I mean, might that circumstantial evidence analysis be different in a case like this, given those facts?
Different perhaps, Your Honor, but not dispositive for a few reasons. It's very much like Pierce, because even though it's a citizen, we know where she lives. And she said she saw this communication on her laptop. And this court still found that was insufficient. Again, here, yes, he's a Waseca County police officer. Police officers use cell phones. Police officers are mobile. This occurred during the COVID pandemic, when we know a lot of folks are working in lots of unusual areas. And moreover, Your Honor, there are facts in this record that sometime about the time Ms. Johnson called Detective Brass back, he was going off duty. We know this because he testifies he had informed the next officer on about how to handle the case, to go to the hospital, to yada, yada, yada. So what we don't have is any, again, this is really simple to elicit and the state didn't do it. We have no idea whether he's already off duty when he receives the call, whether he's in his office, whether he's at his house, where he lives. So yeah, certainly they're different facts. It's slightly different than Pierce. But the key fact in Pierce is that the state had only the recipient's address, one piece of information, and didn't establish anything else about where that recipient might be. So even if there's a reasonable, on circumstantial evidence, a reasonable inference on this record that he was at the station, that's not the only reasonable inference. Because just like Pierce, we have no other information. I see that my time is about to expire. So if this court has no further questions, I would ask you to reverse Ms. Johnson's convictions on the concealment, deprivation of parental rights offense, and the misdemeanor falsely reporting offense. I would ask you to then reverse and remand for a new trial on either of the issues raised in issue 3 and 4 of the brief. And thank you for your time.
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right, thank you very much, counsel. Your arguments and submissions were very helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory time period.
Thank you.
Thank you. Look, we're ready for our next case. We'll have the marshal reconvene.